It's Friday, March 11, 2011. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The news coming in from Japan looks absolutely devastating. A quake now estimated at 8.9 on the Richter scale occurred some 80 miles off the shore of northern Japan at a depth of about 12 feet. Now, this has led to a giant tsunami that came in at incredible speed and has inundated the northern Japanese coastline. At this point, it is unclear how many casualties are already to be counted, but there is massive damage, and there is reason to believe there may also be a massive loss of life. Japan is on one of those tectonic plates in the Pacific Rim's Ring of Fire that leads to repeated earthquakes. Throughout the 20th century, Japan experienced a series of rather devastating quakes, and it looks like the 21st century may also hold some seismic developments for the nation as well. As we think about Japan, we need to be reminded that it is a very densely populated series of islands that are barely sticking up out of the Pacific in terms of the coastline. We also need to be reminded that where there is a tremendous metropolitan population density, as in Japan, there is the opportunity for a compounded loss of life, not to mention property damage, in terms of what happens when so many people are in such a compressed area when an earthquake hits, much less a tsunami. Now, when we think about this, we need to be reminded as well that this raises the issue of what is often called natural evil. When a natural disaster like this takes place, many questions immediately arise. But as you think about this, keep in mind the fact that Japan is a very secular nation in terms of its worldview. Even though ancestor worship and forms of Buddhism and Shintoism are still in the background beliefs of many Japanese, fewer than about 5% have much knowledge of Christianity at all, and the operational worldview of many Japanese when it comes to the events of everyday life is basically secular. But the question of the meaning of life in the midst of such a natural disaster, especially if it turns out that there was a very significant loss of life as well as property, seismologists are already calling this a megaquake. We need to be praying for the people of Japan as they deal with this new and very urgent crisis. News coming today out of Egypt is not encouraging. Attacks by Muslims on Christians there have led to at least 13 Christian deaths with 140 injured. As the Los Angeles Times reports, the bloodshed on the edge of a Cairo slum renewed concern about the government's willingness to protect the Christian minority. Army units intervened only after Muslims set fire to homes and businesses. End quote. Masoud Younan Abdemak, a 47-year-old Christian who works as a garbage collector in Cairo, said, "The people attacked us and the army was helping them. The army was among those who shot at us." End quote. Now, the truth may be difficult to uncover in this situation, but this much is clear. There are real questions now being raised as to whether or not the government now under the control of the military, as a supposedly transitional government in Cairo, is going to protect the rights of the Christian minority in that nation. That's no small question. The big question for Egypt at this particular point has to do with whether its future is going to be that of an Islamic government or an Islamic republic. We have reason to believe that the army has a tremendous investment in preventing that from happening. But when we see the army either standing by and allowing or actively being involved in the kind of massacre here against Christians, this certainly raises the entire question about the self-consciousness of this transitional government and what commitments it intends to keep as it looks to the future. We do know that Christian minorities in predominantly Muslim countries have not fared well in recent decades. We need to also be reminded of what happened in Pakistan over the last several days, as the only Christian member of the government in Pakistan was assassinated, having done nothing but to try to modify that country's anti-blasphemy law. As we look at the world situation, we need to recognize that some of the Christians who are under the greatest threat at present are those who are living in predominantly Muslim nations. We need to watch the situation in Egypt with great care and pray for our Christian brothers and sisters there, but we also need to use our influence as a nation in Egypt to encourage the transitional government to protect the rights of all citizens, including Egypt's Christian citizens. Three of the most important developments this Friday morning in the news have to do with three of our 50 states. First of all, in the state of Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker's bid to curtail collective bargaining among public sector workers has now passed through the legislature after the Senate separated the question of the budget from the question of the collective bargaining rights. Now, the bill will certainly be signed into law by Governor Walker, ending one of the most remarkable political showdowns in recent American history. Now, how should Christians think about this? Christians may differ over whether or not public sector workers should have collective bargaining rights. But we need to keep some certain principles in mind. One is that the government, as much as any family or business or any other organization, cannot in the end spend money that it does not have. Something else we need to keep in mind is the fact that government at every single level faces certain natural limitations. In other words, at some point, there's a tipping point in the economy. If too many taxes are charged against income, then business and personal income simply begin to fall, and you have a diminishing return on the investment of those who think they can fund a massive expansion of government through increases in taxes at any level. Now, as Christians agree and disagree on these matters of economic priority, let's think for a moment about the fact that what we are witnessing here in Wisconsin is a testimony to a major restructuring of the American economy. In times past, certainly looking at the central decades of the 20th century, the labor union movement and the notion of collective bargaining were very important in reestablishing a power equation that did not leave workers at the absolute whim of employers. But when the employer is the people, that is to say the government, then collective bargaining can take on a very pernicious dynamic. But in any event, we're witnessing a major transformation in the economy in which all the old rules and structures of old may appear outdated very fast, if not immediately. Some new concerns about how to establish a just economic order are now presented to us, and it will not do to leave the discussion where it was in the past, which may now be quite irrelevant. We're going to have to be working as a nation through several years, if not a longer process, to determine how we should restructure ourselves as a people on the other side of a great economic upheaval. Not just talking about the recession that began in 2008, but thinking about the fundamental changes in terms of the economy over a much longer period of time. The kinds of issues we're talking about here that came to such a heated political debate in Wisconsin are going to be repeated, if not in every state, then virtually so, and in many other areas of governmental concern as well. We are witnessing a fundamental transformation of the economy. Things could get messy between where we are now and where we must go in the future. Christians are those who know that an economy is never merely about money. An economy is about moral decisions and about cultural priorities, about what is good and to be valued, and a vision of what leads to human flourishing. Therefore, a debate over an economic matter such as this is never just over the money. It's over the understanding and worldview and perspective that goes along with some financial principle or decision. Shifting to the state of Illinois, the issue was not so much the economy as it was the issue of capital punishment. This week, Governor Pat Quinn signed an abolition bill that the state legislature passed back in January of this year. He said this, quote, "Since our experience has shown that there is no way to design a perfect death penalty system free from the numerous flaws that can lead to wrongful convictions or discriminatory treatment, I have concluded that the proper course of action is to abolish it," end quote, it, of course, being the death penalty. Now, as we think about the chronology of this situation, let's look back to the year 2000. At that time, then-Governor Pat Ryan put a moratorium on all executions. Since then, not one person has met the death penalty, at least in terms of execution, in the state of Illinois. We're talking about 11 years now. So in that sense, chronologically, Governor Quinn's signing of this bill appears that is something rather anticlimactic. But there's an historical significance here we need to note. First of all, the governor has signed a bill that was passed by the legislature. Thus, the due process of our governmental system was followed, and this appears to mean that elected politicians, both in the state assembly and in the governor's mansion, clearly believe that the people of Illinois will not muster sufficient opposition to the abolition of the death penalty to endanger their reelection prospects. In other words, this tells us that at least many of those in Illinois who hold elective office believe that the people of Illinois will no longer demand the death penalty. Something else to keep in mind here is the fact that after 11 years of no executions, you can say that at least for the last decade and more, Illinois has had the death penalty only in theory. Now, Illinois becomes the 16th state in the Union to have no death penalty. I will predict that it will hardly be the last. As a matter of fact, what we see in this country is a weakening of the moral system that makes capital punishment sensical. Instead, we are shifting into a very postmodern understanding of the law, of jurisprudence, of criminality, and of sentencing, in which case the law is being turned into more of a matter of therapy than a matter of justice. Now, one of the things that is faced by the people of Illinois now, as they are without a death penalty, is that there is no ultimate sanction for murder. Christians need to be reminded that as you look back to the book of Genesis, it is in the covenant that God gave to Noah that we come to understand the principle that when a murderer takes a human life, by man's hand, his life is to be taken. That is to say, a murderer forfeits his life when he takes the life of another. But we no longer have sufficient moral clarity in this country to understand that the death penalty is actually a great affirmation of life, of the fact that life is so important that the one who takes it must forfeit his or her own life as well. You can soon count on a renewed debate over the issue of the death penalty in the remaining 34 states with that punishment in fairly short order. Finally, in the state of New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo did have the meeting that he promised to have with proponents of same-sex marriage. In that meeting, he said, "For me, this is personal." He pledged to make this a personal priority this very year, as he promised to put his own political prestige on the line to press for the legalization of same-sex marriage. At the end of the meeting, he returned to a point he made earlier when he said, "To me, this is more than just a piece of legislation. This is about the lives of people who I have known for many years who currently are without the rights to which they are entitled." End quote. That statement, reported by the New York Times, recalls the words of Mary Ann Glendon, professor of law at Harvard University, who points out that one of the signs of our times is that the language of right and wrong, that is, the language of morality, has been superseded by the language of rights. But rights talk, as she calls it, is no substantial moral vocabulary for civilized people. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.